This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Is it harder to be truly groundbreaking these days than it was in the past? And are 20-somethings really the ones driving innovation in the tech sector? Here to answer some of those questions today is Ben Jones. His work at the intersection of science and economics, studying what he calls the economics of ideas. Jones is the Gordon and Laura Gund Family Professor of Entrepreneurship, Professor of Strategy, and Faculty Director with the Kellogg Innovation and Entrepreneurship Initiative at Northwestern University. In 2010 and 2011, he served as a senior economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors and earlier served in the U.S. Department of the Treasury. I spoke with Ben Jones during a recent visit to Woods Hole. Ben Jones, welcome to Living Lab.
Great to be here, Heather.
Thanks for making time to come in and chat while you're in Woods Hole. I have to say, going to your website, looking at your CV, and seeing that your bachelor's was in aerospace engineering, and then you go straight from that to a master's in economics from Oxford. What happened in between there? How'd you get from aerospace engineering to economics?
It was actually by way of the environment, because when I studied engineering, I became quite interested in alternative energy technologies. So although it was aerospace, which is a often studies turbines and jet engines and those kinds of things. You can get from jet engines to power generation fairly quickly, and from there you can get into wind turbines. And I was studying wind turbines as an undergraduate, and I began to think that while the technological challenges were important in limiting the use of alternative energy technologies, perhaps policy or economic policy might be important as well. And that, for the first time in my life, really around my junior or senior year as an undergraduate, opened my eyes to economics as possibly being a subject of interest, having taken no economics courses ever in my life, and not really having thought that way about the world before, having had more of a scientific mindset. But I then took a couple of economics courses and found them both enlightening and enjoyable and quite relevant along the lines that I had suspected. And so I actually went off to Oxford to do a doctorate in turbomachinery, following in my original direction. But then sometime over the summer, before I arrived in Oxford, decided that maybe I wasn't quite ready to go narrowly down that route, and I wanted to go a little broader first. And so I ended up doing a master's degree in economics. And as way leads on to way, I never went back.
Never went back and have gotten, if anything, broader and broader.
Perhaps. But I hope I still draw on some of my, although I've forgotten my fluid mechanics, that's for sure. I still try to draw on my scientific curiosity, and certainly the interest in science that I have as an economist, of course, reflects my earlier interest in those
subjects.
I
can guarantee you that you've forgotten more fluid dynamics than I ever knew. So we'll still consider you the expert there. What do you mean when you use the phrase, the economics of ideas?
You know, to an economist, an idea is a very curious thing, because economists think about goods and services and products, right? But most goods and services and products, which are essential material in the economy, are what we call rival goods, which is to say that if one person's using it, it's very hard for the other person to use it. For example, if I'm writing with a pen, it would be very hard for you to write with my pen at the same time. It'd get very awkward very quickly. But an idea, which is an essential economic good, because it's ideas that tell us how to produce things more efficiently or less efficiently, etc., ideas aren't like that. If you're using algebra, I can use algebra at the same time. There's no conflict between one person's use of an idea and another. And that leads to all sorts of magical economic properties. And so economists for a long time are naturally interested in ideas for that, because of those properties, but also fundamentally because to an economist, it's the progress of ideas that really drives economic prosperity.
I mean, you're saying, you know, an idea, you can use it, I can use it all at the same time. And what jumps to mind for me from what little economics I did take in college is that we're getting into the tragedy of the commons kind of thing. And that's where patent law comes in, right? I mean, we've figured out some ways of handling ideas within an economic realm and trying to maybe protect them. I mean, we call it intellectual property. We've figured out some ways of trying to make ideas more tangible. But do they still not really fit into the mold of economics in that way?
It's very interesting, in fact, that we have, as you say, that we've invented property rights, an essential economic property around, or characteristic around, these more intangible things called ideas. But what's interesting, and in fact, what's different from the tragedy of the commons, the tragedy of the commons is when we kind of overuse things. And maybe, like, if I'm fishing this pond, I'm taking fish out of it, so other fishermen are negatively affected. Every time I go out and fish, it makes it worse for everybody else who's trying to fish. But what's really interesting about an idea is another reason that economists are very interested in ideas is because they actually bring benefits in excess of those that are captured by the creator. It's kind of the opposite of the fisherman overfishing. In the following sense, it goes back to what I said before. If someone invents, say take Newton, or maybe it's Leibniz, you can argue about that, but they invent calculus.
Right.
Okay. So you invent calculus. Now, you know, if you're Newton, you're inventing calculus because it's going to help you, say, solve certain problems in gravity and various kinds of things you're studying. Okay, so you've got this new tool, and he'll use that and get some use out of it. But calculus turns out to have all these other amazing uses. Now, Newton is not going to capture all that value. Down through the ages, everyone else, lots and lots of other people, are going to capture massive value from that invention. So because other people get to use calculus too, there are these positive spillovers from the creation that are not captured by the original inventor. And the idea of intellectual property, like patents, is to try to give some of that benefit back to the inventor. They can capture at least some of the commercial value of their ideas to therefore increase their incentives to create ideas in the first place. And the reason we might want to do that as a government is because we think that even if they capture a lot of the value themselves, still there will be enormous benefits to everybody else as those ideas spill over and can be used elsewhere.
Now, you teach a course for doctoral students called The Economics of Ideas, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship. And reading the course description, to me, I'd sum it up as how science works and why it's important. Is that about right?
That's a big part of it.
I mean, it sounds like a course not necessarily for graduate economics students, but something everybody should take to understand how scientists come up with new ideas and how those then make their way into everybody's daily lives.
I think so. I think that there's a lot, you know, about creativity that we study as economists that is of great interest to people who are creative themselves. You know, economists have a somewhat boring way of thinking about the world sometimes. We think about production functions. There's sort of inputs that they kind of go into this box, and out comes a widget or a poem or algebra or a car, right? Okay. And we normally think
about putting a poem at the end of a black box, just like a car.
I mean, it's a shout out to the creatives of the world. But I think we tend to think classically about producing, cars and computers and pens and chairs and oil and those kinds of things. But there's another production function, which you could call the knowledge production function, which is a bit about, well, what are the inputs, like, you know, scientists and grant money and the training of those people and lab equipment, certain kinds of collaboration networks, those kinds of things that are inputs to creativity. And then out of that comes a new pharmaceutical product, a new insight about basic genetics, a poem. It could be anything else. So economists have sort of applied, in some sense, their tools for thinking about production in general to the production of ideas. And of course, for me, it gets very interesting because it links into creativity and sort of very fun concepts and historical figures in science and lots of kind of things that are interesting to read and learn about.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with science economist Ben Jones of Northwestern University. Ben Jones, how much of your research is focused on, say, R&D in the private tech sector, and how much on academia, or can you kind of overlap the two? I mean, they seem to function fairly differently, specifically in an economic sense.
They do. The rewards to a scientist in basic science are quite different than the rewards to an entrepreneur. So in that sense, there are some differences. But, you know, I often study both groups because one of the things I look at a lot is sort of how training and education and experience lead to creative outputs. And in a lot of my work, it turns out empirically that they're not that different, whether you're looking at sort of Edison and thinking about sort of inventions for society versus you're looking at Einstein in some sense. So people who are great in both disciplines actually share some interesting features.
Now, a few years ago, you decided to look into formally a question that I have toyed with very informally for years, and that is whether or not it has gotten harder to be really groundbreaking. I mean, you know, we learn about Copernicus and Galileo and their incredible lives and their genius, and yet their findings, which were so groundbreaking in their time, we now learn in elementary school. We seem to have kind of figured out the basics of the universe. And so now to make a really big discovery just seems that much harder. Is that what your research on the topic bore out?
So yes and no. So I think it is getting harder for inventors to come up with really big, super important ideas. I think there's still, of course, lots of enduring questions out there about basic science, such as, you know, what is dark matter or dark energy? These are fundamentals in the universe that are big puzzles, linking quantum mechanics to theories of gravity at a universal scale in physics. You know, all sorts of disease, you know, our understanding of, and we have these new paradigms coming in, the microbiome or all sorts of interesting things in biology that surprise people. You know, is it really junk DNA or not? All that other stuff in the genome. So I think they're really, really big questions still to answer. But I do think it is getting harder for individuals to solve those problems on their own.
So why is that?
Well, a force that I've really looked at a lot in my work empirically is actually a very simple idea. And it's the idea that over time, over centuries now, really since the Enlightenment, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, we've been accumulating a lot of scientific and technical knowledge. Sometimes you get new ideas, like Copernicus would change how we think about the universe. Or we thought the world was flat, and then we thought it was round. And you kind of out with the old ideas, in with the new.
Right.
But a lot of science is what would we think of as more normal or ordinary science, where you're kind of refining and accumulating ideas and you're building up more and more
just
theories,
an incremental
and facts.
Growth in the same direction.
Exactly. So we know, if you think about how much we know about computers now and just the actual types of engineering that goes into that. A good example of this would be sort of, you know, the first airplane of the Wright brothers and now like a 787. There's just a lot more known about the various kinds of science and engineering that goes into a modern airplane that went into the early versions. And so that's interesting, but where it gets interesting for me is that if you think about individuals, we're all born in every generation with equally empty minds. You know, you're born right. as a baby today, you're born as a baby 100 years ago. You know nothing of all of this information, and yet there's so much more to know now. So what happens? So how do individuals get to the frontier, become experts enough that they can then take the next step forward? And if there's more to know, it's what I call the burden of knowledge. If there's more to know, then you either have to spend longer in education. Okay, which we certainly see. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to be an electrical engineer, 100 years ago, the capstone degree was your bachelor's degree in engineering. Then we'd have a master's, and then you get a PhD. Now you have postdocs.
You know, and you start earlier as well. You start in pre-K.
Well, yeah, that's right.
And
you also
daycare.
You're also learning maybe a lot more in your earlier years. Absolutely. You know, like parents are sending you around to all these different summer programs to get you started, and all these things on top of what you do and what you might do in your primary schooling or secondary schooling. But people spend a lot longer in education. So one thing is that we're spending a lot more on training. And one thing you then see is that people don't innovate as early in their life cycle as they used to. It kind of takes longer to get to that frontier. So people say, you know, Nobel Prize winners used to be reasonably common that Nobel Prize winners would do their path-breaking work in their 20s. And while that still happens today, it's much less likely today than it used to be. People are more likely to be in their PhD and still learning about what is already known in their 20s rather than making the breakthrough insights.
Well, that's interesting because then you've also looked in the tech sector. You know, we seem really focused on this idea. Every year, MIT puts out their 30 under 30, you know, the top innovators that are very young. We tend to think of Silicon Valley as being full of brilliant 20-somethings that are creating the next Facebook or Google. And yet you've looked at it and said, in fact, baby boomers are really important to innovation, that in fact these older people in tech and in research are very important to innovation.
Yeah, it is popular perceptions are not exactly consistent with reality on this one. There, you know, for example, in patenting or writing great scientific papers, those tend to peak in your late 30s or early 40s these days. In your middle age, early middle age, not in your 20s. I mean, of course, there are people who are doing great stuff in their 20s. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg was very young. Steve
Right.
Jobs was very young. Bill Gates, some spectacular people. And of course, there are very, very brilliant people who are young and doing great things at young ages. But if you also think about the nature of innovation, I mean, all three of those examples, Jobs, Gates, Zuckerberg, it's all in computing. It's all at the very, very early stages of a new technology. An operating system for Gates or the personal computer for Jobs or a social network software for Zuckerberg. It wasn't very hard. These were not things where you needed a lot of technical skill.
This is going back to kind of the idea of these are the low-hanging fruit, big ideas.
Right.
like Copernicus and Galileo exactly. did for the universe, just in the computing universe.
Right, because the computing was a revolutionary technology that's become so important across the economy. But at, you know, in each of those phases of hardware, software, and social networks, you know, the early programming, et cetera, the early work wasn't actually that technical. And that allows people who haven't had as much training but are actually innately brilliant, for example, earlier access to doing frontier level work as entrepreneurs or otherwise. But, you know, in biotech, you know, show me a 22-year-old college dropout who's solved some major cancer problem. We don't really see that so much. There are a lot of things where we have a lot more knowledge that has been developed that's much harder. You sort of need more education to more credibly make fundamental insights.
Although it does seem that every year there's at least one story of some teenager who has come up with a new, you know, paper-based test for pancreatic cancer or some really revolutionary new idea. And in fact, I've had conversations with people working in the opposite direction, wondering, not are we, you know, going to see older and older innovators, but in fact, are we going the direction of the 20 under 20 instead of the 30 under 30, that technology perhaps makes it possible for even younger people who maybe as teenagers, their brains are not as hindered by rules and some of that knowledge, that might actually be thinking in very, very creative ways at a very young age.
So I think young people may have certain advantages in creativity. Young people probably have advantages in just pure deductive horsepower. But where they're disadvantaged is in sort of having the kind of knowledge bases in their heads that allow them to see big picture questions or see combinations across very different fields. So, for example, the model of creativity often involves combinations. A lot of creativity is the combinations of existing ideas into new things. It may be that there's psychologically a capacity for really unusual combinations in a younger mind, but at some level there's also less constituent ideas, rigorous ideas in that mind to combine. And so there's sort of trade-offs, and we actually can see trade-offs across the life cycle on those dimensions.
That's Ben Jones, economist of ideas from Northwestern University. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Ben Jones of the Kellogg Innovation and Entrepreneurship Initiative at Northwestern University. His research focuses on the economics of innovation and creativity. Now, just a moment ago, we were talking about how creative young people might be, even into your, you know, getting back to being teenagers, not even just 20-somethings, but that they've got then a knowledge gap. And I wonder whether you think the internet, Google, this technology that holds such a vast store of information and puts it at everyone's fingertips can help make up that knowledge gap, or whether that's not quite sufficient, whether you really have to have all of that information in your head and have to have gone through all those years of learning.
I think it helps, but it doesn't solve fundamental aspects of the challenge. So it helps in the sense that these are really search and access technologies. So for example, if someone wants to know what has been said about something, they don't have to go to the library. They can much more quickly get a pretty good sense of that. And in fact, other things like you can look at which papers are cited a lot, or which, you know, the whole way Google works, for example, which pages are linked to a lot. You can find things that are in some ways community vetted as being potentially important. And so it can orient you pretty quickly on, within this vast, vast array of knowledge, on possibly very important constituent material. So that's very helpful. But the challenge, of course, is that knowing something is not the same as knowing where it is.
Very true.
And, you know, to really understand an idea, I mean, I could say to somebody, I've been able to say to somebody for a long time, you want to understand vector calculus, here's a textbook. But I don't just hand it to them and they know where it is. It'll take them a while to understand vector calculus. I could say to someone, here's a cello and here's some music. And I would say, there's where it is. But of course, it's not going to be overnight that they can play the cello. A lot of things take a long time for the body to understand and know how to use ideas or skills, research skills, et cetera. So unfortunately, while I think, you know, the organization of information and our capacity to search it is actually extremely helpful, it does not, we don't have a technology yet necessarily that makes people absorb that information and understand it in a faster way. And that fundamentally is a major limitation.
Could working in groups, working with other people, be a way to help overcome that you don't have to hold everything in your head? two heads are better than one, five are better than two, that if we start putting together groups together, we can overcome this burden of knowledge?
Absolutely. So I said before that, you know, in response to sort of being born into a world with more and more knowledge in it, you might spend longer in training, and that might affect your life cycle of when you're creative, maybe delaying it somewhat, which we see in data. The other aspect, of course, is, well, there's so much out there to know, I'll just be narrower, right? I'll be more specialized. I won't have to know everything myself. So we chatted briefly about airplanes before. So think, go back to the Wright brothers. That was two guys, right? And they were the leading aeronauts of their time. You go to the 787, you know, it takes maybe 30 different disciplines just to do the jet engines. Okay.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's just a lot of technology, a lot of very specific knowledge that's going into these new airplanes. And so what do we see? We see this move from people being narrower, deeper experts because there's so much more to know. So they kind of go deep to the frontier. But by nature, if they're going all that time going really deep into the knowledge on a particular topic, they're going to be narrow. You know, you're not a biologist anymore. You know, you might understand, you know, cell transport or protein folding, or you might do something ecology. These are very different fields.
Right.
So people have to get very narrow and expert. And the way you solve that problem is, well, I still want to ask or answer a hard, broad question is exactly your point, which is, we'll have a collaborate. So we can assemble people with complementary types of specialties, like you do, say, with the jet engine of a 787, and they together, through teamwork, can collectively overcome to some degree the challenge of there being so much to know.
Is there a role in all of that for a shallow generalist? Do you need perhaps one person at the top who doesn't understand every part of the jet engine, but is a single brain with the big picture idea to help coordinate all of those moving parts?
That is a great question, and I think there's a lot of reason to think that is in fact the case, although I don't think this has been well studied. But if we're speculating a bit, yeah, exactly. How do you coordinate a team of people? How do you get people who speak different technical vocabularies to talk to each other? Who has enough knowledge to see that big picture and be the bridge and the grease organizationally between the rest of the team? That strikes me. It just strikes me that, you know, you're going to create, as the world gets with more and more knowledge, as there's more and more knowledge in the world, you have sort of more demand for these specialists, but then also more demand for these generalist integrators. You know, if I can wildly speculate here, so this is a wild speculation, but, you know, we know, for example, that CEO pay has gone way, way, way up. You know, what is a CEO? A CEO is a very, very good generalist integrator across a lot of different business components in big companies. Once again, they often are maybe very capable at sort of being able to bridge and connect and motivate and do all these things across very wide scale collaborations.
So maybe those CEOs actually deserve their paychecks, that they're an innovator not because they can know exactly what's in the jet engine, but because they can have the big idea and somehow foster all of the necessary collaboration and technology that actually goes into innovation today.
So with the caveat that we're definitely speculating empirically, yes. I mean, that if you followed it through, maybe they are, in fact, this is the sort of the rare birds who are so good at that integration function in very complex organizations with complex technologies that they can bridge those groups. Yes.
As it has gotten more difficult, I mean, it definitely sounds more complicated to be innovative now, that you need a big team and you need technology and you need a manager, as opposed to just being some brilliant guy with your telescope on a patron's, you know, castle turret or whatever it is. It seems that we've gotten to a place where we're being very deliberate and very conscious. We're trying to understand the ingredients that go into innovation and figure out how to foster it and how to do it right. And sometimes it feels almost forced. But is that perhaps a necessary outcome of simply where we've gotten to, that we're going to have to make a conscious effort? We can't just fall into innovation through innate brilliance anymore.
Yes, I think there are real challenges here. I think collaboration sort of helping solve them by bringing together these different types of expertise to solve tough challenges. But now you do have to coordinate across all these people. I mean, the poor biomedical principal investigator who runs a lab now, spending so much time writing grants, hiring people, organizing a team, you know, not, you know, thinking great thoughts, looking across at the horizon, being very deeply creative themselves, but finding so much of their time and energy devoted to management. You know, it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting how as science has scaled and these collaborations have scaled, how top scientists have to have these whole different set of skills. You can't just sort of take your bicycle out for a ride in the woods and be very good at thinking about an idea. You have to engage in these more management oriented tasks, which I think is, which is challenging.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Ben Jones about his research on the economics of science and innovation. Ben Jones, you've served on the White House Council of Economic Advisors, and President Obama, as we all know, is very big on the green tech economy, R&D as an economic driver, both basic research and in the private sector. What do you think the government is doing right at this point in terms of science policy, either for academia or for the private sector, to try to support innovation?
The U.S. government over a very long time, really going back to the Vannevar Bush and the post-war, has had a very enlightened science policy, recognizing early and going back to things we talked about earlier in our conversation, that there are these huge positive spillovers from effort at basic science or effort even at for-profit technological innovation, that the inventor or creative themselves captures just such a small fraction of the actual social benefit of a new idea. And if that's the case, when if you will, I'll be an economist here for a second, when the market doesn't provide the right incentives, if I'm doing some activity that brings huge benefits to everyone else and I don't capture it all myself, my incentives might not be as strong as they should be to do that activity. And so the U.S. government and others now have put in place lots of policies to try to promote and increase the interest of individuals in doing science, engineering, et cetera. And so there's patent law, obviously, that's right. Giving you, if I come up with a commercial idea that's effective, I have a monopoly now for 20 years. That's a nice incentive. But of course, we directly push by funding through the NIH or the NSF or other government agencies, a lot of basic research. We have for corporations and companies, we have the R&E tax credit, which is a way for them to take a really big tax credit on certain kinds of innovative investment. So there's a whole range. Of course, we support graduate students and we do other things through the government. I think the Obama administration has been very focused and aware on the benefits that innovation can bring. And when I worked in the White House, the theme of the State of the Union address that year was innovate, educate, and build.
Right.
And it was, you know, it's right up there in the front, and you know, recognizing that while innovation is more of a long run play, it's not about fixing the economy necessarily right now. It is the long run play. I mean, we have to, as a society, as a world, make the investments in innovation that are really what have been driving advances in socioeconomic prosperity and not just income. I mean, health and many other things, and the ability to have a gentler effect on the environment as well. And those are all very important.
I mean, you mentioned the investments that are there, things like tax credits, and yet, at least in academia, federal grant funding has just gotten tighter and tighter. You could maybe imagine that going two ways in terms of innovation, right? As the competition gets tighter and tighter, you have to be more and more innovative. That could be one thing. It could drive people to be incredibly creative and innovative to get those limited funds. Or you could say potentially tighter resources means people are going to go the safe route and this is going to completely stifle innovation because it's too dangerous to take risks. Do we have any sense of what direction the American scientific community is going as grant funding has gotten harder to get your hands on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it has gotten more competitive. And sort of there's sort of two kinds of policy levers here. The most obvious one is, can we just have more money on the table for the NIH or the NSF and fund more? And that's a question for Congress to help figure out. And I would say, as an economist, as an aside, an important aside, that I think we could do a lot more. It would be great for, I mean, the U.S., the share of R&D spending in the United States funded by the federal government has, as a share of GDP, has declined quite a bit over time. And it would be good to double down on those investments. The other thing you can do, of course, is conditional on having a dollar to give. You know, where do you give it? And in the spirit of your question, you know, how do we get to the potentially high breakthrough ideas as opposed to maybe more run-of-the-mill ideas? And there are lots of questions and concerns about whether government agencies are good at allocating scarce dollars to the most promising ideas. And, you know, I think the NIH, for example, is very aware of this question and has tried to come up with funding mechanisms recently or experiment with funding mechanisms that can promote wilder, more creative ideas with maybe better potential for a breakthrough, even if they're more likely to strike out as
right.
well. And that's tough. I mean, it's tough because you want experts to evaluate ideas who they think have a high probability of success. But if it's really radical, it's very hard to make that call. And it's a risky proposition.
I mean, we've also seen, I think, a shift away from basic research in some ways, because, of course, when you have very limited funds, you want to fund the things that seem the most promising, that somebody can make a direct connection perhaps to an impact. But without that base of fundamental understanding there and growing, you're missing the foundation for all of that applied research in the future.
It's a tricky question, that one, because, I mean, absolutely you want basic research, but absolutely you want sort of more applied research as well. And they don't sort of exist in isolation. Of course, they talk to each other.
Right.
And, you know, there's an old idea in science and the economics of science called the linear model, which probably sounds familiar to people. It's the idea that you sort of invest in basic research. You have some basic breakthrough that gets fed out to applied people in the private sector who then build on that into sort of real products and ideas and drugs or whatever it is. But, you know, recent, the last couple of decades, as people have stared at that, they realize it's a whole lot more complicated, because often what happens is there's some private sector or sort of commercial innovation that then becomes a useful tool back into basic research. And it's sort of the things are all going in different directions and it helps. And so it's a little hard to say that, you know, it's better to fund basic versus apply. We don't really have good evidence on how you would balance that exactly, but we think you probably need a healthy dose of both.
That's science economist Ben Jones of Northwestern University. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll take a short break here. When Living Lab continues, we'll talk about the economic costs of climate change and whether science could be an engine for global economic development. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Ben Jones of Northwestern University about his research on the economics of innovation, creativity, and climate change. Ben Jones, that last one seems like a bit of a non sequitur in the list, to go from the economics of ideas, how you foster innovation, to the economic cost of climate change. You have mentioned an interest in the environment since your undergrad days. How did you circle back to the economic costs of climate change?
When people ask me why I study innovation, I often joke that it's a growth industry. And when people ask me why I study climate change, I often joke that it's a hot topic.
Oh, boy.
These are bad jokes. I think by some level, my unifying interest is I think they're both very important. And when I think about the future of the economy over the long run, you definitely want to understand innovation because that drives so much. But, you know, if you think about the risks that are, you know, out there, the minefields in the future, there's a few, but one of them seems to be potentially climate change. And as we talked about at the beginning, I got into economics partly because of my interest in environment, and then sort of studied innovation and hadn't really done much on the environment, and sort of I was always looking for an opportunity to get back into it. Actually, I was, we all have ideas in different places in our environments. I often get ideas when I'm driving. I used to have a car that didn't have a radio that worked, and so I could just stink. I couldn't listen. I couldn't do anything. There was no NPR for me. So I often had good ideas in the car, because when you're forced to sort of not do anything but just let your mind free. And I'd recently seen Al Gore's documentary. And of course, it had followed climate change quite a lot over the years. And it just occurred to me that there's a really basic question that we didn't know the answer to as economists, which is countries have hot years and cold years. And what happens? People are worried what happens when it gets hot to the economy. Well, why don't we just look in history and see that, you know, this country had a hotter year than normal or a colder year than normal, and maybe we could learn a lot about what the effects of climate change are. And having had that thought, I got my great co-authors together, and then with building on their creativity as well, put together a research program that brought us back into climate change as a topic.
Who did you bring together to try to come at this question from perhaps a novel angle?
Well, I have a longtime collaborator, Ben Olkin at MIT. We were in graduate school together, and we'd written a lot together. And we're always looking for projects, and we come up with ideas and work on them together. And we also had a graduate student at MIT at the time, who's now a professor at Harvard, Melissa Dell, who was a fantastic contributor in that first paper, and then, you know, a leader on our other work as well. So, you know, in that case, I was going to my social network. If you want to get back into the economics of creativity and innovation, we often collaborate through our social networks. But these are also people who I thought, you know, bring the clearest empirical thinking about how to identify causation, how to identify Like, what would the actual causative effect of temperature be? And to think very carefully empirically about how we can do that. Whereas the standing literature in climate change at the time wasn't really basing its findings on what most economists now recognize as particularly convincing empirical methods.
Well, we've seen this issue of causation come up just recently, a report that came out a few weeks ago showing that, or at least concluding, that drought in Syria contributed to the civil war there and sparked a whole conversation about, well, you know, can we say that the drought caused the civil war? That seems too strong given the social situation there, long-standing situation. Did it contribute to it? Are we sure? Is this just a correlation? Does it really mean anything? So how do you try to disentangle that in your own work and feel confident that what you're seeing is an actual economic impact of climate change and not just a coincidence?
Right. So this is where the power of statistics can come to help you. And that's a great example, because you could argue about Syria and the drought till the cows come home, and you can't convince a skeptic one way or the other, because it's just one observation. And it's hard to know with just one observation. But let's say we could collect all the observations around the world that we can find of countries. Take all the countries in the world. Some have drought sometimes, some don't. Okay. And let's say we believe that droughts sort of strike, you know, for reasons of weather, which are really kind of coming randomly or not to various periods of the world. And then you could ask, well, systematically, Syria might be one observation, but systematically, when there's a drought, do we see greater civil conflict? And that could still happen by chance, but that's what statistics helps you. Statistics tells you that if I got a whole bunch of observations together, it could tell you, well, the chances of that relationship between drought and conflict happening by chance is less than 1%, or less than 1 in 1,000, or less than 1 in 10,000. And so there's always a chance that it could have been random, but you begin to be able to say, it's very unlikely that was by chance. And in fact, there may be a strong empirical relationship between drought and civil conflict. And in fact, incidentally, there is a relationship between drought and civil conflict in the world.
So based on your research, what are some of the social and economic costs of climate change if you compare, or at least of warming, because that's really only one aspect of climate change. But if you compare hot and cold years, as you did, what are some of the economic and social costs?
So we decided in our first project to look directly at GDP growth, the overall growth in the economy, which is going to net out lots of different kinds of things that might be going underneath. I mean, temperature could hurt agriculture. It might have effects on industry. It might make people sort of stay home or are lazier in high heat. It could have very broad effects. It could create conflict. It could create political instability. It could have lots of forestries, anything. So if you look just at GDP, which is sort of bringing all those things together into one metric, we asked, all right, well, when a country, taking every country in the world, when a country's had a hotter year than average, did we see any effect on its GDP? And we kind of expected we wouldn't see anything, frankly. That's kind of
really?
I was surprised. I'd be surprised if, I mean, but by what I mean, you know, a country might be a year, in one year might be 1 degree centigrade hotter. And you say, well, would you see an effect on GDP of that? But it turns out that you do in poor countries. So
really?
Poor countries that are 1 degree C hotter on average over a year have 1 percentage point slower growth in GDP per capita, so that in income per person. In rich countries like the U.S., it's noisier and we don't see any obvious effect. So that finding, which is that's a very large effect just incidentally, right? So, you know, countries don't grow that fast, right? So, you know, a 3% growth rate in a year is pretty good. So what we're saying is if you're 1 degree hotter and you're a poor country, you go from 3% to 2%, okay?
Right. But OK, so then climate change, though, is not happening for the most part. I mean, there will be, you know, hotter years. But if you want to talk about the global average change in temperature, we're talking about 1 degree C over the past century, not over the past year. When you slow it down like that, is that really enough to start seeing significant effects on economies, do you think?
Well, that's a very good question, because you know, in climate change, we're talking about more sustained changes, and people will have more opportunity to, say, adapt. And that might make the effects that you find in the short run larger than you'd find in the long run, because people will sort of plant different crops or that are more attuned to the new climate, et cetera, or they'll move away from climate spots that are tough. And so you could imagine we'd adapt. But you could also imagine that things intensify. Like, to go back to drought, for example, 1 year of low rainfall could be bad. But if you had reservoirs of fresh water and irrigation, you might not really make much of a difference. But if you had many years of low rainfall, you could intensify the effect, right? And suddenly you really have a serious problem and you could have sort of cataclysmic effects on agriculture. So it could kind of go either way in how you get from the short run to the long run. One way to get at that empirically is to look at longer periods of time, not just a year. So we also look, for example, at 15-year periods, 10-year figures, 15-year periods. And you see the same actual findings. So if you have kind of a hot 15-year period compared to what you were 30 years before,
right.
You also see the same kind of negative effect in poor countries on their growth rates. So that suggests that at least in the medium run, you don't see a whole lot of net adaptation or intensification. It's sort of fairly, still pretty bad. But again, you know, 15 years, 30 years, that's not 100 years. And so if we're looking at, to say, the year 2100, you're still having to get more speculative to think about the effects.
What do we know or do you think are some of the factors that protect more developed economies from those impacts? Why aren't the wealthier countries experiencing, or don't they experience, the same kinds of economic impacts during those warm years or warm periods that the poorer countries do?
So I think there are several things. So first of all, poor countries are very agricultural.
Right.
So they're naturally more exposed to the climate in their main sector. So you might have thought that's the difference because, you know, in the U.S., we have lots of farming, but it's a very small percentage, 3%, say, of GDP. In a poor country, it's going to be half of GDP. And there are large negative effects on agriculture of warmer temperatures, and we can establish that in lots of data. So that's part of it. But actually, what turns out to be really interesting and also really surprised us when we first studied this was that it's not just agriculture. In fact, the effects on industrial output are just as bad.
Really?
And that actually, so how would that be? Well, it turns out that, you know, if you go back to really old thinking on sort of why temperature might be bad for output, it's this old idea from Montesquieu, which is that, well, when it's hot, we all feel tired and we don't work as hard. Labor productivity just goes down when you're hot. And so it turns out that that also seems to be true in the sense of lots of lab experiments, but also if you look at you know, call centers, people do experiments with lots of workers in the field and show that, you know, when the temperature goes up, their productivity decreases quite sharply, actually. And in fact, and very similarly to what you see for agriculture. So it's not just the agriculture. But what's, of course, interesting on industrial output and then, you know, rich versus poor is that in rich countries, we're all air conditioned. But in poor countries, you have your, quote, sweatshops. Okay,
right.
So they're very exposed indoors to external heat in ways that are, you would see lots of industrial losses as temperatures go up. In the U.S., you know, you turn the heat up outside, if you're in an air-conditioned factory, it's not going to matter so much. So I think, you know, this is going to sound almost silly, but one of the pretty interesting things that's emerged from this literature is that one of the advantages of rich countries in terms of being protected is that they're air-conditioned, and so you're actually less sensitized in your workplace to actual weather that's going on outside.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense, though. Heating would be the same thing.
Absolutely.
You know, if you can control your indoor climate, regardless of what's going on outside, then you've got some buffer from the weather. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. The challenge, then, is the fact that we can't turn every country in the world instantly into a wealthy country.
Correct.
So how do we help these countries develop into wealthier, more buffered societies, but do so in a sustainable way? And could a more innovation-based economy play some role in getting there?
So this gets, of course, to the deeper question of why we have such huge differences between rich and poor countries around the world, and what is it that's holding back poor countries? If you played our story forward that we were just talking about, maybe one solution for poor countries is to get wealthier themselves so that they can then have the adaptive means to sort of make themselves less sensitive to climate change. And that then engages a massive literature and community of scholars who think about why poor countries are poor. And of course, if the answer to that was simple, the World Bank would have solved poverty a long time ago. And so that's a hard one. And it's hard because increasingly we think that one of the main challenges for poor countries is governance, its institutions, its corruption, its weak property rights, bad legal systems, its a tendency towards conflict, its a lack of stability in the transition between leadership and political institutions. And in fact, if you go back to the climate and just, you know, to bend back there, there's a third reason that rich and poor countries might be quite different. And one of the reasons you might not see effects in rich countries compared to poor countries. The other thing we see is that when poor countries have, say, droughts or very high temperatures, we see much more political instability. So whether it's civil conflict or changes in leadership, we see lots of problems. And those, of course, may be partly coming because of economic problems leading to discontent and leading to changes in leadership, but also changes in leadership and civil conflict have massive negative effects on economies. So it's just kind of everything's kind of going in all directions there. It's a little hard to disentangle. But in well-off rich countries like the U.S., where we have robust political institutions that are, you know, the tenets of which, the basic separation of powers of which are not going to be, are very hard to change. We have potentially a political system, a governance system that itself is much more durable in the face of any kinds of shocks, including climate shocks. And that may also explain why we don't see serious effects in rich countries like we do in poor countries.
Are there people trying to innovate in this space, trying to come up with new ways to perhaps break that cycle?
You know, if it is governance, you know, it's a little hard to change governance from the outside. You know, corruption, for example, is once it sets in a very widespread way through a government of a country, it's very hard to get rid of it. And these kinds of problems are very tough. But it means that we need to be engaged with poor countries through all of our means, whether it's, you know, the World Bank or other development institutions or bilaterally. Trade policy, helping them get to a better place. With regard to innovation, innovation itself is what fundamentally drives growth and prosperity in a country like the U.S. because we're kind of at the frontier of technology. For a lot of poor countries, it isn't necessarily the challenge of innovating per se. They don't need to invent a better computer. They just need computers. They don't need to invent better health technologies. They just need doctors, and they need vaccines, and they need antibiotics, and they need cleaner water. They need a lot of things that they're actually within. They need to do things that are within the set of knowledge that we know, that people in the world know how to do, but haven't diffused to those economies.
And yet there could be innovative ways to address those needs, because sometimes the reasons that those technologies, the things that we know, have not penetrated is because of some external challenge that you might be able to innovate your way around. Do you think that education and fostering innovation in those places, getting the people who are most affected by those problems to think innovatively, to collaborate, could actually help them work their own ways out of these problems?
To some extent. I mean, it's possible that the technologies that are so-called appropriate technologies in the U.S. context don't diffuse to, say, Rwanda, because they would have to change. I mean, like a type of crop that does very well in Kansas may not do well at all in Rwanda. So there's a certain amount of innovation in the sense that you need to innovate appropriate technologies for those environments. But with regard to capital goods and machinery, I mean, they should work pretty much most places. With regard to an antibiotic, it should work pretty much most places. So while there's definitely some room for innovation, and that's important, going to your point about education, I think it's much more about providing the, you know, education in the population so that they can implement best ideas, better ideas, but also provide the institutional environment that protects real property rights, contracting, governance, less corruption, that taxes so many businesses and individuals, that allows them to, you know, simply buy and implement machines, you know, buy a tractor for your farm, you know, buy good inputs for fertilizer or crops, and not have a local bureaucrat come and take it from you, or a corrupt official take it from you. And all of those problems that get in the way is simply people doing what we know how to do, but are afraid to make the investments in.
Ben Jones is Gordon and Laura Gunn Family Professor of Entrepreneurship, Professor of Strategy, and Faculty Director with Kellogg Innovation and Entrepreneurship Initiative at Northwestern University. He's also a former member of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He joined me during a recent visit to Woods Hole. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.